Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It was a misty night in Edinburgh. The kind of October evening where the wind off the North Sea cuts through even the warmest coat. Inside the World's End pub on the Royal Mile, the atmosphere was the opposite. Warm, lively, and crowded with locals and friends sharing drinks, laughter, and stories. Two young women, Helen Scott and Christine Eady, sat with friends, chatting and soaking in the night. They'd stopped by a few pubs earlier in the evening, and this would be their last stop before heading home. But what should have been an ordinary night out would end in unimaginable tragedy. The next day, Helen and Christine would be found brutally murdered, victims of a killer who would elude justice for decades. Their deaths would change the fabric of Edinburgh's community, haunt Scotland for nearly 40 years, and ultimately rewrite the law. This is the story of the World's End Murders, a case of unimaginable loss, relentless determination, and justice delayed, but not denied. You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Thanks for listening to our podcast. For an ad-free experience, join us on Patreon, starting at just $2 a month, with 25% of proceeds supporting the Doe Network, helping to bring closure to international cold cases. Our episodes cover true crimes involving real people, and some content may be graphic in nature. Listener discretion is advised. We produce each episode with the utmost respect for the victims, their families, and loved ones. In the fall of 1977, the Scottish capital of Edinburgh was alive with its usual charm and vibrancy. As darkness fell over the cobblestone streets of the historic Old Town, 17-year-old friends Helen Scott and Christine Eady were excited for their Saturday night out. The two teens had been close friends since their time at Firrhill High School, sharing a love for life and excitement about their futures. Christine had left school at 16 and was employed in a surveyor's office. She was known for her independence, sharing a flat in Abbey Hill with an older friend, Tony Whale. Helen was described by her family as a shy and quiet girl, working in a tartan shop on Princess Street and aspiring to become a nurse. She had just received her first paycheck and treated herself to an expensive Burberry coat, her pride and joy. On the evening of Saturday, October 15th, they met friends in the city center and embarked on a pub crawl. Helen's parents knew she was out on the Royal Mile that night and expected her home at her usual time of 11:30 p.m. Helen began her evening by meeting up with her school friend, Jacqueline Ingalls, at the Mount Royal Hotel on Princess Street. The two friends caught up over drinks before making their way to Grosvenor Bar, where Christine and her flatmate Tony were waiting. The group was in high spirits, enjoying the lively atmosphere of Edinburgh on a Saturday night. As the evening progressed, the four friends visited several pubs along the Royal Mile. Their final stop was the bustling World's End Pub, where they arrived just before last orders. Helen and Christine managed to find seats in the crowded bar, and before long, they caught the attention of two men, who approached them and struck up a conversation. These men stood out, sporting unusually short hair in an era of long locks and handlebar mustaches. Jacqueline and Tony were keen to leave World's End and go to a house party, but Helen and Christine decided to hang back for a while. They said goodbye to their friends and left the pub at 11:15 p.m. with the two strangers. As the group made their way onto the cobblestone streets, Christine stumbled, and police constable John Rafferty, who was just passing by, helped her back up. He saw Christine and Helen walking off into the foggy night, not suspecting that they were in any kind of trouble. If only he knew, this would be the last time anyone saw the girls alive. Helen's parents were worried when she did not arrive home at 11:30 and waited up all night. Her mom recalled the phone ringing sometime before midnight, but when she wanted to answer, it stopped. The next morning, Helen's worried parents called all of her friends, but no one knew where she was. They reported her missing at the St. Leonard's police station. Then, the worst news came. At approximately 11 a.m. on Sunday, October 16th, a couple walking their dog at Gosford Bay in East Lothian made a horrifying discovery. The body of Christine Eady was found lying on her back near the beach. Her hands were tied behind her back, her ankles bound, and she had been gagged. Just hours later, another grim find was reported by a farmer in a field near Haddington, about 6 miles from Gosford Bay, Helen Scott's body. She was lying on her prized Burberry coat, bound and strangled in the same manner as her friend. Both girls had been sexually assaulted. Police immediately launched a large-scale investigation, determined to find those responsible for such brutality. Detective Sergeant Tom Wood, who would become intimately involved with the case for decades to come, remembered the atmosphere at the police station that Sunday afternoon. The place was already buzzing. There were senior officers all over the place, and there was a real feeling that we were dealing with something different here. The crimes shocked Edinburgh to its core. These brutal, calculated murders represented what D.S. Wood would later call the death of innocence in the city. Two teenage girls, barely more than children, had been abducted from the heart of Scotland's capital and subjected to unthinkable violence. For the investigators, the challenges were immense. This was 1977, decades before DNA testing, CCTV cameras, social media, or cell phone records. There was no quick way to track the victim's final movements. Everything had to be done manually, with detectives working through the card index systems containing tens of thousands of entries. When Helen's mom mentioned the late-night phone call, they could not determine who had used the pub's payphone, so they couldn't say for sure if that was Helen calling home or not. Detectives were able to establish that Helen and Christine had last been seen leaving the World's End pub with two men. They worked tirelessly to identify these individuals, interviewing hundreds of witnesses and compiling detailed records of everyone present in the pub that night. In the end, they had the names of 273 people who were there at some point on that night. However, with no CCTV, forensic capabilities still in their infancy, and a reliance on paper records, the investigation was painstakingly slow. Detectives quickly recognized several crucial details. The crime scenes were highly organized, suggesting methodical killers who had either done this before or carefully planned their actions. The locations where the bodies were dumped showed strategic thinking, good sight lines to spot approaching vehicles, remote enough to avoid discovery. But perhaps most tellingly, the ligatures used to bind the girls showed different knot types. Reef knots on one victim, granny knots on the other. This suggested two killers working together. The police's efforts included cross-checking alibis, tracking known sexual offenders, and responding to public appeals for information. Yet, despite the vast scope of the inquiry, which involved interviewing thousands of potential suspects, no arrests were made. As months turned into years, the investigation went cold. However, the case was never forgotten. It remained open, with detectives revisiting it whenever new leads or advancements in technology offered a glimmer of hope.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
For 12 years after Helen's murder, her mother Margaret carried the weight of not knowing who had taken her daughter's life. When she lay dying in 1989, her husband Moran made her a solemn promise at her bedside. He would not rest until he found the men responsible for Helen's death. The wait would be long. It wasn't until 1998, 21 years after the murders, that DNA analysis finally yielded a profile from Helen's coat. The UK spearheaded DNA database creation in 1995. Investigators were certain they would get a match from criminal databases. Surely, someone capable of such crimes must have offended before or since. But when they ran the profile through databases in Scotland, Europe, Australia, and the United States, they found nothing. The team refused to give up. They collected DNA samples from every surviving male who had been in the World's End pub that night. They tracked down potential suspects internationally, investigators traveling all over the world to secure the integrity of the chain of custody. Still, nothing matched. Then, finally, in 2004, the breakthrough they had been so desperate for came. A small private company used new technology to separate different DNA profiles from the sample. They found not one, but two male DNA profiles, confirming the investigators' long-held theory about two killers. When they ran one profile through the database, they got a hit. Angus Robertson Sinclair. Sinclair was already serving life sentences for raping 11 underage girls. He had never been on the World's End suspect list, but his DNA was a billion to one match. When investigators identified him as one of the killers, D.S. Wood remembered thinking, "We've done it." Sinclair, who would have been 33 at the time of the murders, voluntarily provided a swab. Although he denied any involvement in the murders, investigators learned that he lived in Edinburgh at the time. They knew he was their guy. But they would need more evidence to prove it. The second DNA profile was eventually matched to Gordon Hamilton, Sinclair's brother-in-law. Hamilton had died in 1996, but investigators ingeniously obtained his DNA from residue left behind in a house he had decorated shortly before his death. So who were these monsters who had been right under their noses all those years? Angus Sinclair was born on June 7, 1945, in Glasgow. He grew up in St. George's Cross, a working-class neighborhood in the northwestern part of Glasgow. Life in Glasgow during that time wasn't easy, with the area facing economic struggles and limited opportunities. Sinclair didn't do well in school and left at the age of 14. By 13, he had already started getting into trouble, caught stealing from a church collection box. A year later, in 1959, he was charged with housebreaking, marking the start of his long history of criminal behavior. But there was a deeper darkness lurking within Sinclair. His sordid history of sexual violence and murder goes back to when he was only 16 years old. In 1961, he was convicted of culpable homicide after raping and strangling a 7-year-old girl, his neighbor, Catherine Rehill, in Glasgow. Reportedly, Sinclair was the one who called for an ambulance, saying, "A wee girl has fallen down the stairs." Investigators immediately knew that Catherine's death was not an accident, but Sinclair refused to tell them what had happened. However, thanks to his older brother John, Angus Sinclair eventually confessed. John Sinclair made the following stunning remarks about his brother, saying, "I would have done time for him. I would have killed him. If I'd known years ago, I'd have pushed him in the bloody canal. And all these people, all these girls, would never have had that." Angus Sinclair was sentenced to 10 years in prison for culpable homicide. The judge who heard the case said Sinclair was callous, cunning, and wicked, while a psychiatrist's report warned that he would remain a very dangerous sexual case and a menace to the lieges. "He is obsessed by sex, and given the minimum of opportunity, he will repeat these offenses." Despite the serious warnings, he only served 6 years in prison before being released. After his stint in prison, he trained as a tradesman and seemed to be integrating into society rather well. In 1970, he married a nurse in training called Sarah Hamilton, George Hamilton's sister. 2 years later, the couple welcomed a son into their home. During this period, Sinclair worked as a painter and decorator, maintaining an outward appearance of normalcy. But the monster within would rear its head again. Between 1977 and 1981, Sinclair went on a rampage and raped and indecently assaulted girls aged between the ages of 6 and 14. He was arrested and faced 13 charges, including rape and indecent assault. He pleaded guilty to 11 of these charges and was sentenced to life in prison. By this time, the World's End murders were a distant memory for many, though they remained an open case for Edinburgh's police. Until the DNA evidence broke the case wide open. Although Sinclair was already incarcerated, investigators would not stop until he was also tried for the World's End murders. They had to consider the strong probability that he had committed more murders. Based on similar evidence related to other cold cases, investigators established that between June and December 1977, Sinclair's sexual crimes escalated to murder. He went on a killing spree, murdering 6 women in just 7 months, including Helen Scott and Christine Eady. Other victims include 36-year-old Hilda McCauley, Agnes Cooney, who was 23, and Anna Kenny, only 20, all from Glasgow. All of these women disappeared after nights out, and their bodies were found dumped on deserted farmland or waste ground. Another victim was linked to Sinclair, 37-year-old Frances Barker, who was abducted near her home on Maryhill Road in Glasgow. Truck driver Thomas Ross Young was convicted of her murder in 1977, despite his pleas of innocence. In a startling twist, Wilma Sutherland, the last known person to see Anna Kenny alive, married Gordon Hamilton, Angus Sinclair's brother-in-law and suspected accomplice, just months after this series of murders. Some detectives find the connection too unlikely to be a coincidence, further reinforcing the belief that Hamilton played an active role in the crimes. Because Hamilton was deceased by the time investigators pinned him and Sinclair for the World's End murders, his culpability is often overlooked or underplayed. Other than Sinclair's brother-in-law, who was he? Gordon Hamilton was born into a large working-class family in Glasgow and was one of 10 siblings. A quiet and reserved individual, Hamilton was described as a bit of a loner, with limited social connections outside his family. While working as a warehouseman in Glasgow, Hamilton enjoyed hobbies such as football and karate. Despite his outwardly unremarkable life, his close bond with Sinclair led the two men to frequently take weekend trips together, claiming to go fishing, but often returning without a catch. He was 10 years younger than Sinclair and looked up to him. Significantly, Hamilton lived with his sister Anne Sinclair in 1977 in Edinburgh, placing him in close proximity to Sinclair during the time of the World's End murders. He married Wilma Sutherland in 1978, but a major falling out with Sinclair on his wedding day led to the two men cutting ties. Either way, Hamilton could not be charged, so investigators focused solely on Sinclair. In 1998, there was a cold case review of Mary Gallagher's 1978 murder in Glasgow. She was sexually assaulted, strangled with her own clothing, and her throat was slit. Despite extensive investigations, the case remained unsolved for over 2 decades. A DNA profile was obtained from a semen sample found on a pubic hair collected during the original investigation. This profile matched Angus Sinclair. Sinclair was subsequently charged with Mary Gallagher's murder. The jury found him guilty, and in June 2001, he received an additional life sentence for her murder. DCI Brian Murphy of Strathclyde Police said this with regards to Sinclair after interviewing him regarding Mary's murder. "He's one of the most evil people I've certainly interviewed in my life. There were things going on in his head which clearly I couldn't reach." In 2007, 30 years after the World's End murders, Sinclair finally stood trial for the killing of Helen Scott and Christine Eady. The prosecution's case relied heavily on DNA evidence, arguing that the presence of Sinclair's genetic material proved his involvement in the crimes. However, the defense countered by claiming that Sinclair had consensual sex with the victims and that Hamilton was solely responsible for the murders. In a shocking turn of events, the judge ruled that there was insufficient evidence to convict Sinclair, and he was acquitted. Public outrage followed, with many criticizing the prosecution's reliance on a single strand of evidence. There was, of course, other evidence that was not presented in court, like a damning eyewitness account from 1977. On the morning of October 16, 1977, Robert Cunningham was on his way to work when he spotted a light-colored caravanette backed into the field in East Lothian. Sinclair's vehicle fit the description. At the time of the trial, Robert was no longer alive, but dogged detective work found his statement among the thousands of index cards used at the time. DS Tom Wood commented, "I still don't understand why supporting evidence was not led. And I mean, while I can't speak for every police officer in Scotland, I certainly know that for those who were on the investigation with me, and who are still serving officers and can't speak openly about this, there is still an amazement that it wasn't done."
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
A guilty man had escaped justice on a technicality. This was unacceptable. And to make matters worse, due to Scotland's double jeopardy law at the time, Sinclair could not be retried for the same crime, even if new evidence came to light. Even if he confessed, the Crown's hands would be tied. However, the impact of the World's End case was so severe, it became a catalyst for legal reform in Scotland. In 2011, the Scottish government repealed the centuries-old double jeopardy law, allowing retrials if new and compelling evidence emerged. This change gave renewed hope to detectives and the families of Helen and Christine, as it paved the way for Sinclair to be brought back to court. Following the repeal of double jeopardy, police launched a renewed investigation, focusing on proving Sinclair's guilt without a reasonable doubt. Advances in forensic science allowed for a closer examination of evidence. Using a process called spermolution, combined with crime-light technology, scientists examined the ligatures used to bind the victims. They found Sinclair's and Hamilton's DNA deep within the knots, proof that both men had been involved in restraining both girls. This evidence, combined with the original findings, formed what they needed, a compelling case. In 2014, 37 years after the murders, Angus Sinclair faced justice again. Sinclair's was the first trial to be held in Scotland following the ending of the double jeopardy rule. This time, the prosecution presented a meticulously detailed case, leaving no room for doubt about Sinclair's involvement. Witnesses, forensic experts, and detectives all contributed to a narrative of premeditated violence, with Sinclair and Hamilton luring the girls to get into Sinclair's caravanette outside the city center pub, driving them to remote locations, and subjecting them to brutal assaults before killing them. The jury took less than 2 hours to find Sinclair guilty. On November 14, 2014, he was sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum term of 37 years, 1 year for each year Helen's and Christine's families had waited for justice. This was the longest minimum sentence ever imposed in Scotland at the time. Judge Lord Mary Matthews addressed Sinclair saying, "These girls had no idea of the terrible misfortune it was to be in the company of two men whom no words like evil or monstrous will ever adequately describe. You have displayed not 1 ounce of remorse for these terrible deeds. The evidence in this case, as well as your record, details of which have now been revealed, shows that you are a dangerous predator who is capable of sinking to the depths of depravity." The conviction of Angus Sinclair brought long-awaited justice for Helen and Christine's families, though it came decades too late. The case demonstrated how advances in forensic science can shed new light on decades-old crimes. It showed that with dedication, persistence, and scientific progress, even the coldest cases might one day be solved. After keeping his promise through decades of investigation, failed trials, and legal battles, Moran Scott finally saw his daughter's killer brought to justice. In a cruel twist of fate, Moran passed away just 1 year after Sinclair's conviction, on October 16th, the same date Helen's body had been discovered in 1977. Angus Sinclair passed away in prison in 2019, taking many unanswered questions with him. While he was never formally charged with other crimes, he is widely suspected of being responsible for numerous unsolved murders. A study by scientists at the University of Glasgow analyzed more than 1,000 murders in Scotland between 1968 and 2004. Their findings identified 6 cases with a unique signature, concluding that Sinclair and Hamilton are responsible for all the linked crimes. The report highlighted striking similarities in the methods used to bind, restrain, and kill the victims, patterns that were not seen in any other cases or offenders. As retired Detective Tom Wood confirmed, there was a clear pattern. The victims were all young women who had been out for the night. They all disappeared from the streets, were transported a distance, bound in nearly identical ways, and subjected to similar assaults before being murdered. Despite these significant parallels, prosecutors determined there wasn't enough evidence to connect Sinclair definitively to the Glasgow killings. If Sinclair was indeed responsible for these additional murders, he would rank as Scotland's most prolific serial killer. In the years that followed his estrangement from Sinclair, Hamilton's life deteriorated as he battled alcoholism and homelessness. He died in 1996 of a heart attack during an emergency procedure to fit a pacemaker. Following his death, his family burned his belongings, leaving little trace of his life apart from a single photograph that was later used as evidence in the World's End murder case. We may never know the full extent of the crimes in which Hamilton acted as Sinclair's accomplice. Thomas Ross Young, the man who was imprisoned for the murder of Francis Barker, continued to plead his innocence until his death in July 2014. Forensic evidence, including bleached hairs matching the victim found in the cab of Young's truck, his admission to police about possibly committing the murder during blackouts, and the victim's personal items discovered in his daughter's possession and under his floorboards, caused the court to turn down his final appeals. Young was also convicted of 2 attempted murders, 2 rapes, and other offenses, but always maintained his innocence throughout his life. No one has ever been charged with the murders of Agnes Cooney, Hilda McCauley, and Anna Kenny. Helen Scott and Christine Eady were just 17 when their lives were stolen from them. Their legacy lives on in every cold case solved through advances in forensic science and in every conviction secured under Scotland's reformed double jeopardy law. For the families who waited nearly 4 decades for justice, for the investigators who never gave up, and for Helen and Christine themselves, the truth finally emerged from that terrible October night in 1977. As D.S. Wood reflected after the final verdict, "We made a difference." If you'd like to dive deeper into this case, check out the resources we use for this episode in the show notes. Don't forget to follow us on social media for more updates on today's case. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and X. We also have a channel on YouTube where you can watch more content. If you enjoy what we do here at Evidence Locker, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now, and consider leaving us a 5-star review. This was the Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.
Yo, it's Jay Uso from WWE,
and I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.